I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I think this is a really big deal. This network, Wisconsin Public Radio, is celebrating its 100th birthday next year, 100 years old. And as Jack Mitchell writes in his just-released book in celebration of this big event, we are the oldest and most committed not-for-profit radio station in America. Jack has written about the 100-year history, and it is fascinating. I was particularly interested in the early years and what was the guiding philosophy for the people who put together this network. Wisconsin on the Air is his book, 100 Years of Public Broadcasting in the State That Invented It. And Jack was director of Wisconsin Public Radio for 21 years, 1976 to 1997. He was also the first employee of National Public Radio and helped develop All Things Considered. He has received the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's Edward R. Murrow Award and another award for National Public Radio Distinguished Service Award. He joined the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communications Department in 1998, and we're happy to have him as a guest. And welcome phone calls, too. So any questions you have about Wisconsin Public Radio from the time that he was here when he made some significant and I think very welcome changes to what we were doing to Wisconsin Public Radio 100 years ago, which is a story we'll start with, of course, we would love to hear from you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Facebook, if you want to leave messages, we'd love to hear from you. If you want to wish us a happy birthday on Facebook, we'd like to read happy birthday messages. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Hi, Jack. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi. Good to be here.
You know, I never knew all of these stories of these brilliant people, not only engineers, but brilliant philosophical thinkers who got this whole thing rolling back in 1917, all part of a Wisconsin idea, which changed a little bit, but the initial Wisconsin idea, the guiding light, is a fascinating story.
Yes, it's this was part of the progressive movement, which in the early 1900s, we had across the country, but particularly in Wisconsin, this movement of reform. Mm-hmm. The idea that big businesses and just big institutions were squelching the people who were not part of the, well, we'd say today the 1%, but back then they didn't use that term. But it was essentially the same, and that we needed to give the 99% opportunities that were seen as lacking at the time. And so we had a lot of changes, a lot of institutions, reforms were invented and instituted at that time. Things like antitrust laws, child labor laws, and reforms in the civil service, direct election of senators, primary elections, mm-hmm. things that were designed to give power to people. And they needed education to function well. And that was all part of the Wisconsin idea. A very radical view, seen at that time as radical. And looking back at it, it looks pretty radical to me as well.
Yeah, it does. It really does. So how did that get translated as a mission for education and the University of Wisconsin to a similar kind of mission for public broadcasting in the state?
Well, public broadcasting started in the physics lab at Science Hall in Madison. The main goal at that point was to build equipment that would work. And so these students, under the direction of Professor Earl Terry, worked on building transmitters. And eventually you get one to work, and then you have to do something with it. And in most places, this was happening all over the country in different universities, most places they said, okay, we got it built, let's tear it down and give you an A in the course. But here in Wisconsin, Professor Cherry, who was living in this environment of reform and the Wisconsin idea and the progressive movement and the idea that we should be using this mass medium to actually do some good, mm-hmm. and to advance the mission of the university, and to foster democracy. And that was really what it was all about, was trying to build a more democratic society. And we needed a place that would allow that to happen, or at least to encourage it to happen, because, you know, no one institution could do that. And the other piece of this is the idea that for-profit institutions can't do everything. There are lots of things they can't do. And that had to do a lot of things in government. For example, you know, the state got involved in regulating the environment and things that couldn't be done with just a private enterprise system. Mm-hmm. And the notion that we shouldn't be trusting our news and our discussion of public issues to profit-oriented organizations, because they are were seen as intrinsically somewhat corrupt and certainly not fair and open, because they were owned by businesses in order to make money. Mm-hmm. And that we needed organizations. One time they were looking at newspapers that would be run by universities so that they would be fair and balanced and accurate and all the things that you associate with a university. That didn't happen here in Wisconsin. It did happen in a couple of other places. But here, they had this new technology came along called radio.
Right.
And this idea, and they came together in the early 1900s to form what was then called educational radio.
Hmm. So they had, I found this fascinating early when you talk about, he must have had some really top-notch engineers. Terry must have been a top-notch engineer as well. But you write about the transmission of voice and music required glass vacuum tubes. They were not manufactured commercially, so the students would blow molten glass into the shape that was needed, put the electronics, get them from the air tube to create a vacuum, and it took a long time to master the techniques, but then you had to keep making these tubes. It's amazing.
Yeah, because they kept blowing up. They kept blowing up.
Oh, my gosh.
And so, they were, it was a constant battle, and they were even supplying them to other organizations, because this was one of the few places where people were actually good at it.
Hmm. So when Professor Terry and his wife Sadie invited faculty, deans, and friends to hear the first broadcast in their living room, what did they hear, Jack?
Well, they heard a record called Narcissus. It was a piece of popular music of the time. And one of the students was in Radio Hall in the basement, and he set up the phonograph and a telephone speaker or telephone microphone in front of the speaker, and they played this tune, and it went up to the roof of Science Hall, and then they strung a wire from the top of Science Hall over to the smokestack
of the old
heating plant, which became Radio Hall years later. And they broadcast it to this house. And the people couldn't quite make sense out of it, didn't quite know what was happening. And one lady, indicated that, she was as confused as everybody else and really had no idea that this was all that important.
Hmm. In the early days, let's talk about how the station was structured. It wasn't wall-to-wall broadcasting. There were certain times of day that broadcasts could be on the air, and it was heavily, because we're an agricultural state, there were, what, farm reports?
Yeah, it started off that way, primarily agricultural extension. We had here a very important extension service for agriculture and home economics. And so that was the most natural way, because I think like 60% of the farm families were illiterate. They couldn't
60%
read.
60%, Jack. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, this is back around 1920. Huh. And so how are you going to reach people? Well, you can do it by print, but it's certainly more efficient to do it through language so mm-hmm. people can hear it. So they used this instrument first for farm and weather markets, homemaker information. That was the first programming. But there was quickly, other things were added very soon after that. Yeah, but that reef was the core at the very beginning, agriculture.
Mm-hmm. I remember working at WGN many, many years ago when I was in college during my breaks, and they had Orion Samuelson. I remember him to this day, who did a farm report at noon every day. I thought, I loved it. It's, wow, a farm report here in Chicago.
Yeah,
this is good.
Covered half the country.
Yeah.
Is he still around? I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. I'll have to look that up.
Yeah.
You made me think of him. And the Homemaker Program, tell me about the woman who did this show, who became dearly beloved and did a Homemaker show for, and a little bit more than that, for years and years and years.
Yes, her name was Aline Hazard. Everybody called her Mrs. Hazard, and she was a rather formal person, always dressed well, and I'm sure as you do when you're
right.
There.
Right.
You know,
I have my shoes on.
Yeah, well, she had a hat, and she was Mrs. Hazard. But she was on every day at 10 o'clock in the morning for 6 days a week, Monday through Saturday. And she had home advice, homemaker's advice, but she also did things like music appreciation and civic information and trying to speak with rural wives, homemakers, on a number of levels, not just how to keep your house clean and nice recipes, but beyond that, she saw them as far broader in their interests.
Mm-hmm.
And she was... When you think about a farm wife in a farmhouse on several acres of land, the nearest other woman, other than perhaps her daughters, would be, you know, maybe a half mile away. And so the person that these housewives encountered every day, regularly, more regularly than anybody else, was Mrs. Hazard.
Hmm.
And so she became, in a sense, their best friend. She developed a huge, loving following. And she was on the air from, into the 1960s. She started, I think, in 1930-something and went into the 60s.
Do we have tape of her somewhere? I'd love to hear that show. We do.
I'm sure there are. I have not heard them. But.
Yeah, I would love to hear that. So you talk about, let's go to what the mission was, the Wisconsin Idea, what kind of broadcasting we did in response to the Wisconsin Idea. Let's move ahead a few years. No, let's go to World War II first, and then we'll move ahead a few years. Because I'm interested in what stations did and what we did during the war years. What was our responsibility as a broadcaster?
Well, the first thing they did was get news. They bought a news wire service. I think it was AP at the time. And they started doing war news. And that was a big innovation, because prior to that, it had been mostly, you know, faculty talking on the radio from, you know, talking about history or talking perhaps about how to milk a cow, those range of topics. But they were mostly faculty types. Now this was the beginning of real news. And in addition, they did programming, of course, for military purposes and for the war effort, things, information about other countries and patriotic programs. And so they did a lot of that. But there was not, they were very careful, and this was really important. There's a very important professor who was chairman of the radio committee for the university for about 30 years, and he really put his stamp on the public affairs aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Eubank, Heine Eubank, and he was chairman of the speech department, and was interested in debate, and was very committed to the idea that we need to explore openly all kinds of alternatives. And so he and the board of the radio station at the time insisted that they would not get involved in propaganda, that this will be fair and balanced, and even Hitler has, there's something that must be said, could be said about him, that would be, you know. So there was not going to be a propagandistic thing, which was very different from the way a lot of media went during that war. But it was this principle that we are going to be fair, we're going to be balanced, we're going to listen to all sides, and then make up our minds, but that you can't really make up your mind if you don't hear all sides of the issue.
Mm-hmm.
So that had begun prior to that. Back, you know, the 1930s, they'd been using that philosophy. But in World War II, they reiterated it when it was controversial,
mm-hmm.
when people were objecting to that idea. Mm-hmm. But they stood firm.
There have been a number of people who've been at Wisconsin Public Radio for all kinds of years, and we'll talk about some of the personalities. I want to start with Carl Schmidt, who I believe he just died recently, and I hadn't realized until I read his obituary he got hired in 1941.
1941,
wow.
That's right. Yeah, and I think he's probably was been on the air here longer than anyone else.
I would imagine.
It was over 60 years that he was here. And he was still doing Chapter a Day. In fact, when he died, they were running one of his books.
Yes.
And he was very active right until the end. He was still recording books until within a few months of his death. And he started in 41 as a student. He came here from Ohio. Now, Ohio State University had a radio station, but they weren't very good at radio drama. And Wisconsin was very good at it. The founder, the key person who was the first manager began in the 1930s, late 20s, early 30s, was H.B. McCarty, who was essentially a showman. He was an actor. And so he prized that skill. And so there are a number of very good announcers and actors who were on the staff here. And Carl was among the best. In fact, I would say he probably was the best. And he began in, 1941. He went off to the war for a couple of years and then came back. And a whole generation of people came in right after the war. Carl came back, a man named Ken Ost, who some will remember,
sure.
Cliff Roberts, others who were the great voices of WHA and the Wisconsin State Stations, as they were known then.
Mm-hmm. So let's jump way ahead now. How were you wooed to come to Wisconsin Public Radio? And what made you accept the offer?
Good question. I was... first of all, I'd been here. I'd worked here in the late 60s for 1 year as the state capitol reporter. And so I knew the place, and I was and liked it. You know, I was from Michigan originally, and I came over here and in 68. And I say I liked the place a lot, and I liked the whole tradition, everything it stood for. But then I had the great opportunity to go off to London for a year working at the BBC in preparation for the start of NPR. And I went back, and then when I came back from the BBC, I went to NPR instead of coming back to Wisconsin. And I spent 6 years there in the formative years, but I always really thought that I would end up coming, if not coming back here, at least coming to a university, because I had my PhD and, you know, I was qualified, I had all the credentials for a university. And then in 1976, Ron Bornstein, who was head of broadcasting, who I had known before, called, and the manager had died. A woman named Clara Kensler had died rather tragically of brain cancer at a very young age. And he persuaded me to come back at that point. It was really tough because NPR was, you know, I was right there at the beginning of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just had invested so much of myself in it. But I could see that ultimately I really belonged in a place like the university. And I'm very glad I made the move.
Mm-hmm. And your first thing that you were looking at pretty early on, you were kind of shaking things up here, which is a good thing to do, I think, Jack. But we were having two services broadcasting essentially the same programming.
Right. It gets very complicated, and probably nobody other than myself cares. But we had two different licensees. We had the university, and then a state agency called the State Radio Council.
Mm-hmm.
And the State Radio Council had built a system of FM stations around the state. And they were licensed to the state. And WHA in Madison was licensed to the university. And it was fine for many years as long as one man, H.B. McCarty, was head of both. But because of the coming of public television and some other political things that got things very messy, the two split apart. And the Straight Radio Council, which became known as the Educational Communications Board, became quite separate from the university. But they were carrying the same programming. It was the programming on WHA fed the state network. And here in Madison, we had two stations essentially doing the same thing. And by that time, this was 1976, the notion of that FM had become pretty much equal to AM. And they should be doing different things. There were two different stations. So through some negotiation and fence mending and trying to get ECB staff and the WHA staff working together, we decided that we would bury the name Educational Communications Board, we would bury the name WHA, and we would call it Wisconsin Public Radio. Mm-hmm. And Wisconsin Public Radio would be what we said publicly about it. We would act as if we were one organization, even though we were two. And that took some work. But we ended up with one station, the AM station, primarily talk, and the FM station, WERN in Madison, primarily music.
Right.
And then that evolved over the years. But that was a very big deal.
That was a big deal, and a big deal for you because you had to create programming for one of those stations, right?
Yes, we had to create two services where in the past we'd done one.
Uh-huh.
So we had to make everybody more efficient because we didn't have any more money. And so we did things like, well, what you're probably doing, you're probably operating your control
board.
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, in the past, prior to that, there was an engineer who pushed all the buttons and you had nothing to do but talk.
Mm-hmm.
And now just as it had been going on in commercial radio for years, each person did both. Whether it was a music show or a talk show. And so we essentially did things. We moved this style from a pre-World War II style of radio, which were big productions, to the more intimate, more conversational approach that commercial radio had gone to already. And it was more efficient, and we could get two services out of it.
And did people say hurrah, hurrah, or did they say, Jack, what are you doing?
Jack, what are you doing more often
than not?
Did they
really?
Oh, really? Yes. Although once it got going, when we talked about doing it is when we had all the criticism.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people in the university particularly were concerned that we were losing touch with the university. And there is a certain legitimacy to that concern. In fact, I still wonder if we haven't perhaps drifted a little bit far from the university, farther than we might have, perhaps should have. But still, the notion of serving people and trying to talk to listeners in a direct way about things that they care about was what we were what was all about. And then playing music that was important, but informally. In the past, they had written scripts, and they would read this rather formal script working. Whereas now, with music, is done hosted in a rather personal way. You don't hear that in Milwaukee, but around the rest of the state, we have two services, and the music is very informal and personable, and the talk service is, I think, equally informal and accessible to people.
Let's welcome phone calls for you, Jack. We have many more years to go in the 100-year history. Jack Mitchell, former director of Wisconsin Public Radio from 76 until 97, and he's done a really interesting history. We have a lot to be proud of here at WPR, and sometimes I think we don't tell our own story very well. Well, he's telling our story, and it's quite historic. Wisconsin on the Air, 100 years of public broadcasting in the state that invented it, 100 years, and that's 2017. We'll mark that auspicious occasion. Two phone calls for him in a moment, 800-486-8655. Go to our Facebook page as well. We love to read your comments. I'd love for you to wish Wisconsin Public Radio a happy birthday, and it would be a nice record for all of us to write down what your deep memories are of Wisconsin Public Radio over 100 years. Maybe some of you remember 1917. Jack and I are going to be at Boswell Books, too, if you want to have a conversation at the bookstore. Jack will be there with his book, and I'll be interviewing him on Thursday night of this week. It's in Milwaukee. It's a great bookstore, and we'll have fun. It's 7 o'clock Thursday evening. To you, all of your phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls for Jack Mitchell. Kenneth in Janesville is first. Jack, hi, Kenneth.
Hello. I'd like to go right back to the beginning. And I guess the controversy about whether UW was the place where wireless broadcasting was invented and then becoming the first radio station.
Yes, that's a very controversial and somewhat complex issue. We were not the first radio station. That was, you know, Marconi. Start with that, but you know, he was transmitting. But we're the first. I would say we were the first public radio station. In other words, a station that was designed to serve the public interest, as opposed to being an experiment. Or eventually some more commercial stations went on the air. We were not the first station by any means. We may be the oldest in the sense that the regents of the UW had the license back in, I think it was 1916, and I don't think any other organization has had a license that long that continues to have it. The organizations have come and gone. But it's not fair, it's not accurate to say that we were the first. We were not even the first to broadcast voice and music, but we were the first, I believe, and I think this is safe to say, we did invent the notion of public service radio, meaning that we were the first place to have this piece of equipment and actually use it for something worthwhile.
Hmm. Well, that's good. It's too bad we weren't the first, because it's always good to say that, but I like the way you framed it. We're important. We're historic.
Well, we are. The fact that, you know, the phrase that I think in the title that means most to me is in the state that invented it.
Yes.
100
yes.
years of public broadcasting. Because of this state's political and cultural heritage, the progressive movement, the La Follettes, the Van Hise, all these people who were national leaders mm-hmm. in the progressive movement, they set the stage for a very unique approach to education in the University of Wisconsin, but also a unique way of applying radio to that mission.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did. And I think I would defend that statement, that we invented the concept of public service broadcasting, but I cannot say that we invented broadcasting.
Yeah. And sometimes the conversation perhaps became a little bit too progressive. I was fascinated to read about this discussion in 1945 of birth control, and it created quite an uproar.
Yes, it did. In fact, well, it wasn't that. It seemed like a big deal to the people involved, although I don't know that too many people in the rest of the state. But we had there was a panel discussion about birth control. There were four students on the panel. Two were Catholic, two were not Catholic, and they all agreed to keep religion out of the discussion. But some people in the religious community objected that this should not have been talked about on the radio. And the program director ultimately resigned. Now, he said it was to sort of just end the argument, end the discussion, although I think he probably would have left anyway. But the thing is, this happened at exactly the time when the state legislature was considering the proposal to build the state FM network. The stations outside of WHA.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were creating the State Radio Council to build what eventually became WHA FM in Madison, WHAD in Delafield, and all the other FM stations. So it happened exactly at that point. And so although it probably wasn't that big a deal, really, it scared the folks who were trying to get this passed. And some legislators were, of course, concerned that constituents were concerned. But it was a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Kenneth, for your call. Mike in Madison. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for this subject. I would like to ask your guest what his opinion is on Wisconsin Public Radio and National Public Radio, for that matter, also public TV, to inform the public the seriousness about global warming and climate change and the need for people to start changing to do this. So can WPR have any editorial policy that just it funds long distance vacations to make money, essentially? I think they're corrupted by that.
The public radio and TV?
Yeah, he's probably talking about trips that people.
Oh, those? Yes. Oh, could be. I don't think they are necessarily particularly corrupting, although they are a way to, raise money for the organization, because, state money and other sources are not going up. But the notion, there are two aspects here. One is the idea of providing all sides to an issue. And I think public broadcasting does a pretty decent job of that. And the other is to educate people about things that are scientifically proven. And I think that this case of global warming has been pretty clearly scientifically proven. And therefore, it's not necessary for public broadcasting is every time we say there's global warming is happening, that have somebody else come on and say it's not happening.
Right.
But we do have to keep in mind that, there is another side to the argument. It's pretty weak, but there is another side, while trying to emphasize the scientific basis of it. This is a university, after all. It should be evidence-based. And this university, one of my points in the book is that public broadcasting reflects the university, any university, academic values, the notion of being fair, balanced, fact-based, scientifically based, historic perspective, the context of an issue, all of these things that universities do, and most of us in our daily lives tend not to do, and that for public broadcasting to reflect, as no matter what topic it deals with, to bring in these academic values. So I think the academic values would say that we have to be, that global warming is pretty much a fact, and although there are those who dissent, and we should reflect both of those facts.
Yeah. You were talking about money. Let's talk a little bit more about money, because it seems to be a perennial conversation for the many years I've been in radio. 79, was it? We went to doing pledge drives?
Yeah, our first pledge drive was 1979. And it was a very controversial thing.
I imagine.
Yeah, TV had been doing it a little bit, not as much as they do now, but they were getting into it. And other stations around the country had been doing it. But the Wisconsin state stations had been funded quite well by the state and the university. And so we were not in the desperate need for it the way some other stations were. When the Reagan tax support for public broadcasting, when it went under the Reagan administration, it was cut, the national money. That did, in fact, put pressure on us. But we were just trying to, at the beginning in 1979, before those cuts, we were essentially just trying to see to involve people in the organization. And so we set a goal of $15,000. For 3 days. We would be on the air for 3 days and would raise $15,000. Well, we raised $15,000 the first day.
Ooh.
So we raised the goal to 45 and made that.
Ooh.
Well, okay, then we realized that, in fact, there is support out there for public broadcasting, and it did help us do some things, $45,000 worth of things that we couldn't have done before.
Sure.
And so I've forgotten exactly what we did, but we added, you know, made some improvements in the service. And then later in the 80s, it actually became a necessity just to maintain the service as it had been.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Mike. Thanks for your call. We go to Tom in Minocqua. Hi.
Hi. Two quick observations first before my question. It occurs to me as you're talking about the original mission and some of the priorities, that's pretty much still being fulfilled by Larry and Kathleen, Central Time, and other hosts and programs. The second, in terms of the Wisconsin idea, it's kind of the idea of the university or the boundaries of the state being the boundaries of the university or whatever. I always thought it was important to recognize the connections that's established in fulfilling the Wisconsin idea. And boy, a few things in our state do that, like Wisconsin Public Radio. My question, though, is I really became aware of this during the Senate Watergate hearings and the House impeachment hearings in the 70s. And I'm wondering if there were events like that or certain particular big things that really were catalysts for increased listenership over the years of Wisconsin Public
Radio.
Yeah,
that's an interesting question.
Yeah, actually, on a national basis, see, NPR began in the early 70s, 1970, 71, and Watergate happened about 74, about 3 years into our history. I was there. In fact, I covered some of that stuff. And Watergate did help put both radio and television, public radio and public TV, on the map, because only public radio and public television were broadcasting those hearings live, gavel to gavel. And so the only place to hear it was, say, public radio or public TV. So that was change point for public broadcasting, both radio and TV. I think the building of the state FM network was important in this state, starting in 1945, because now people all over the state could hear the service as opposed to just people in the Madison area. So that was a huge step forward. The introduction of All Things Considered, a national program, made a big difference everywhere in the country. But it didn't catch on right away. It took a while for it to build. And I think this is something that's just true of radio in general. It's very much a habit-based medium, and people just turn it on, and they're in the habit of turning it on, and they have the two or three stations that they listen to, and they turn them, switch back and forth a little bit. But it takes a long time for people to discover something new. And so All Things Considered was not a hit immediately. It took a couple of years for it to catch on, and Watergate was a very big event that affected WPR. Something on in the state, I mean, the program What Do You Know with Michael Feldman was a total break from the style that people had been kind of accustomed to. It was very controversial when we put it on. But that did, in fact, you can notice a big increase in listenership when that program went on. And then it sort of lifted the rest of the network, too, because people tuned in for that show. And I said, oh, there's other things here, too. And so that made a difference here. The dual service here, when we suddenly there were two sources. If you like classical music, here was a station that did it most of the time. And if you liked information and talk, you had stations that did that most of the time. That made a big difference. So it's there have been a number of things. And I don't think there's any one event that you can really point to. But Watergate's a good one. That was a big deal nationally.
Yeah. And we should talk about, when we talk about Watergate and when we talk about All Things Considered, the Public Broadcasting Act, because when you think about it, in the scheme of history, public radio and TV in this country is not that old, is it?
50 years. It'll be 50.
Gee,
it was
whiz.
Interesting. We were, public radio in Wisconsin was 50 years old in 1967, which was the year that they passed the Public Broadcasting Act. So I divide the book, actually, and at that point, the educational broadcasting years up until 67, and then the public broadcasting years, which were afterwards. And that act was Well, first of all, radio was not supposed to be in it. Mm-hmm. That was the first important element. And the radio, a few radio people just were obnoxious in demanding that radio be inserted into the law. Public television folks hated that idea because they wanted all the money for themselves.
Sure.
And radio said, no, we need our piece of it. And they were successful. And there's a whole story there, but I don't go into in this book. But the notion that was added, that public broadcasting added to educational broadcasting, one, it took away instruction as a mission. Because here in Wisconsin, instruction, the school programming, was very important in the early days. The Public Broadcasting Act said, well, fine, public instruction is great, but we're not going to pay for it. That's not public broadcasting. We want to reach the public, not just schoolrooms.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second thing was to bring in ordinary people, voices of real people, as opposed to strictly people with credentials, which had been educational radio. You had professors and doctors and lawyers and all kinds of folks who knew a lot more about issues than you and I do.
Mm-hmm.
And that was worthwhile. But the notion in public broadcasting, we want to bring in real people and hear them directly. We want to keep the experts, too. You know, we want the credentialed people, but we want to bring in real people. I think the program you did just before this one,
that was real people.
That was public broadcasting at its best. That's exactly what we had in mind back in 1967, that kind of dialogue between people. It was great because you had people from the inner city of Milwaukee and talking to folks in Rhinelander all around the state,
right,
and sharing ideas. And I was really moved by that program. And I said, you know, this was all worthwhile.
Good. I'm glad I felt that way, too. Yeah. But that had to have been controversial, too. And there's a part of the book, I think, when you started call-ins, where somebody said, oh, you're just those stupid callers. I don't want to listen to those stupid callers, I think, before the phone calls came on the air, because most of the people are not stupid callers, not by a long shot.
Not at all. If they were stupid, they wouldn't be listening to this station.
Right.
And there's one professor who I think I talk about in the book who said, yeah, we don't want these stupid callers. And I said, well, think of it as sort of like students in your classroom asking questions. He said, I never take questions in my class. They're always stupid.
Oh,
well,
yeah.
Okay, well, that's we didn't have much to say, I guess, after that.
Maybe you shouldn't be teaching.
Yeah.
Let's take more phone calls. Jack Mitchell is our guest. The book is Wisconsin on the Air, 100 Years of Public Broadcasting in the State That Invented It. Jack's going to be at Boswell here in Milwaukee on Thursday. I'm going to have a chance to interview him, and he'll talk more about this book and sign the book for you. So all of you public radio fans, you can ask your questions and meet Jack, who played a big role in the development of Wisconsin Public Radio as we know it when he was director. And he was director for quite some time, 76 until 97. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to, actually, let's go to an email, Jack. I'm a native Madisonian born in 1954. Our family happened to be good friends with Roy Vogelman and Cliff Roberts. WHA has been ingrained into me and our family as well then as well as now. Can you discuss how WHA radio and TV was then, I guess in 1954, and versus now? What are the biggest changes?
Okay, well, in 1954, we were a traditional station that more or less as commercial radio had been as well, where you had half-hour programs, 15-minute programs. They had a beginning, a middle, and an end. They were scripted. Somebody wrote, you know, out what was going to be said, and other people read the scripts, read the announcements of that. So you had, in the case of Cliff Roberts, a wonderful, knowledgeable man about classical music, but he didn't speak. He hosted music programs from scripts that were written by somebody else. He knew more than the person probably who was writing the script about the stuff, but he had this magnificent voice and he read very well. And so we had him as, say, you know, in many ways, the epitome of the great radio announcer voice.
He had pipes, right?
He sure did. That's the way we said it. And along with Ken Ost and Carl Schmidt, those were the three big voices. And then Roy Vogelman was a news guy, and but a very traditional. He did a 15-minute newscast. He read mostly wire copy, things that came in written from the Associated Press. They didn't do any real original reporting back then. They didn't go out and cover stories the way Wisconsin Public Radio does now. It was, I used to say that the radio talent in prior to the public broadcasting phase were great readers. They mm-hmm. were always and they read very well, but they were always looking for things that should be read, could be read, that were worth hearing about. But they were reading things, and radio in the public broadcasting era is much more conversational, spontaneous, interactive, and so it's gotten away from scripts and more toward conversation. But it was not necessarily better or worse. It's just a different style.
Mm-hmm.
And because all radio was that way back in the 1940s and 50s.
Yeah. Joan in Milwaukee, hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I feel that I'm part of your story. I was born in 1930 and grew up on a farm outside of Wisconsin Dells, and WHA was our art. It was our music. It was our science. It was a great part of our education, and I think I still have the original radio the station had that Sherry Abrams, who he and Carl Schmidt, when I got to college, were my mentors. And my first job was with Robert Gard's Wisconsin Idea. We were part of the first community theater in the state. And where did I get my background to be chosen to be in that group? From WHA, listening to Professor Gordon and Schwabach.
Oh, that's a great story.
I believe it. Yes, they were, of course, the great school of the year. Teachers, Let's Draw for Schwabach and Let's Sing for Professor Gordon. Thousands of students around the state had their music and art and their science lessons from public radio because most schools didn't have teachers to specialize in those things.
Hmm.
And so, you know, these were one-room schoolhouses or something a little bigger than one room, but still not, they didn't have a music faculty or a science lab or science greenhouses and that kind of thing, which schools tend to have now. So this was opened a whole new world to these smaller schools, and they were very, very valuable. When television came along, it more or less replaced radio in that way. And then, of course, now with internet and computers and all that, even television doesn't do much in the way of instruction anymore. But at the time, it was very important.
Mm-hmm. We have a little over a minute left. Harry in Madison. Hi.
Hi, yes, Harry Carnes. I wanted to get on and just say thank you so much to Jack. You have been such an important part of Wisconsin Public Radio. I was on the Public Radio Association board for a few years back in the
80s. I remember, yes.
And I just want to thank you for your leadership and vision. It was amazing.
Wow. Well, thank you. That's great, Harry.
It's nice to hear. And it's very true. Thanks, Harry, so much for the call. And Joe, let's end on this one. Thanks for the book, Jack. I just finished reading it. Here's my question. How can public radio attract more young listeners now that so few of them are drawn to old media, such as radio? Should WPR hire younger program hosts, for example?
Wow. Okay, if I could answer that one, I would be back in public radio. It's a very important question. The one encouraging thing is that even young people get old eventually.
I know.
And they do tend to migrate to public radio when they get over 35 or so. And I think maybe that's the best you can hope, is that as people turn 35 or 40, they then come to want something a little more substantial than what they've been hearing. But on the other hand, some of the stuff that's being done with podcasts and online is really quite wonderful. And it's a question of whether we will ever get those people to actually move over to radio, or whether radio, public radio, can get into that audience, and to reach those audiences through those new technologies. Mm-hmm. And that's an open question.
Yeah. Jack, thank you. We'll see you Thursday night at Boswell. All right.
I'll be there.
Thanks.
Okay.
Good. We'll have fun. Thanks, Jack. Thanks for all you've done with Wisconsin Public Radio, too. It's a huge contribution. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jack Mitchell, his book is Wisconsin on the Air, 100 Years of Public Broadcasting in the State that Invented It. Jack will be at Boswell Books. I'll be interviewing him on Thursday night. We invite you to drop on by. He'll sign your book for you, and you can talk about our 100 years. I just think it's an enormously good thing that we've been here this long. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this program and for doing on-air production. And go to our Facebook page if you have some memories you'd like to share of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'll use those thoughts on Thursday evening. Thank you for listening.